You're listening to HG 101, a proud part of the Greenlit Podcast Network. Hey there, loyal listeners. As you know, the Top Games Podcast is made possible by Hardcore Gaming 101's Patreon supporters, who help keep this show alive by donating as little as $2 each month. If you were to join them in doing that, you would not only help keep the lights on at HG 101 Towers, you'd also get access to our super secret Patreon RSS feed, which is full of ad-free versions of this podcast with exclusive bonus game rankings. Here's a taste of what you've been missing. The game we're talking about is Alone in the Dark, 2008. This isn't the Alone in the Dark I was thinking about.
Once you get into Central Park, it actually becomes a sandbox game.
How accurate is the depiction of Central Park?
Remember a time when a sandbox map the size of Central Park was considered big enough?
It definitely feels big enough in this game, too. Because you have to drive in the car, it becomes a 50-50 chance that you will accidentally propel yourself off a cliff.
One time I remember I was driving in this game and I drove over a curb and basically the entire car's suspension just flew off.
That sounds like Central Park. Go to patreon.com/HG101 and pledge a couple bucks. That's patreon.com/HG101. Act now and be a hero.
For some, this is painfully obvious, but hardcore gaming means it ain't for the novices. The main source to brain train your knowledge and lay maintain with a course aimed at colleges. To HG 101, we give the honor. Thanks to Kirk, a lot of Xerxes to host it proper, as well as Satanga, Cal and Bobinata, Ogre Hart and others discuss and discover all the 47,000 games. And when they rate them, you can bet it's scientifically locked in position. Speaking of which, no system is obscure. And look, they wrote a book about it. Go out and cop yours.
Hello and welcome to HardcoreGaming101.net's top 47,858 games of all time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. I'm the show's main host and producer, Robbo and or Xerxes. By now, me and the HG101 gang have already ranked well over 500 games. Check them out. There's a list, bit.ly/47kgames.
Dog's power. Dog's power. Yeah. Dog's power. Yeah. Dog's power.
Is this one of your hunches again?
Hello, everybody. I am Satanga. Today's game du jour is John Romero's Daikatana on the Game Boy Color. It has been nominated by Bernie S, B-E-R-N-E-Y, by Apple Podcasts. Developer, Wilco Limited. Publisher, Kemco. Platform, Game Boy Color. Release date, September 29th, 2000, in Europe only. We've got a pretty bizarre one to discuss here. And with it to discuss me are...
I'm Bobinator.
I'm Texalbam.
And I'm the Great Clade.
With me to discuss it. That's what I meant. Ah, jeez. Oh, well, close enough. I don't normally host these things. I knew I'd botch it somewhere, but...
Great intro for a great game.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. The shit show has begun, so to speak.
Okay, that's kind of unfair, because straight up, this is not anything like the PC version, except the very barest plot.
Oh, yes. Oh, jeez, where do I even start with this?
So, Tenga, tell us, how do they put a first-person shooter on a Game Boy Color cartridge?
Well, by completely not making it a first-person shooter. I mean, I forget if there have ever been... the only first-person shooter I can think of that was on the Game Boy, normal Game Boy, as it were, was Faceball. That somehow got ported to there.
There is this one called Tyrannosaurus Tex.
Oh, yeah.
It got canceled, but apparently some company picked it up, finished it, and now they're selling it. So you might want to look into that if the idea of the FPS on Game Boy Color interests you at all.
I gladly will. Also, there have been a fair chunk of first-person shooters on the Game Boy Advance that Derek Alexander, Stop Skeletons from Fighting, has covered. Go look at those videos. Random plug. Sorry, I just thought of that.
there was a bit of a Wild West era where they thought they can just port everything to the Nintendo handhelds. There's the somewhat now famous unreleased Resident Evil 1 port to the Game Boy Color, which sounds impossible, but does actually sort of work. So I'm surprised that they didn't take the Nintendo 64 and PC version of this game and then ported it as a shooter, because that would have been the icing on the cake. Because I would have loved to play a first-person shooter direct port on the Game Boy Color just to see what kind of train wreck that is. But it's not. Instead, we got a top-down action-adventure.
As a matter of fact, this game, on first glance, looks like Zelda. They made pretty much an entirely, absolutely different game out of this one, and the results are cromulent. I don't want to give away too much of my hand right away, so I guess I should just take a little step back. If nobody's heard of Daikatana,
do we really need to tell people what Daikatana is if they're listening to this podcast?
Yes, if it was 20 years ago.
I'll just listen upon the faintest of details. John Romero, one of the big bosses of id Software, who made Doom with John Carmack and a very dedicated team, you know, had a bit of a falling out with Carmack and then made his own company, Ion Storm, which then allowed him to make his own passion project, Daikatana, which Romero was going to release, like, in 95, but he kept chasing the dragon of upgraded graphical engines, and Daikatana went way, 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 way over time and budgets, and finally released in, I believe, 2000 to grotesquely underwhelming reviews, the game itself being considered a complete failure, very buggy, very problematic, and is now pretty much one of the most infamous games of all time, not just on a PC, but basically ever. You have probably heard of it at some point, if not just for its very crass advertising campaign. And that's the very, very abridged history of Daikatana that I can tell you. How somebody decided to make a Game Boy Color quote-unquote port that is pretty much an entirely new game is beyond me, but someone felt it was an idea to pursue, so, eh?
Yeah, even more curious, this game has a Japanese development team, but the Japanese and American versions were actually cancelled because of the N64 and PC games' poor reception. So we only got the French, English, and Italian version, which is like 3-in-1 cartridge, which is neither was neither released in the country where it was made, nor in the country where the parent game was made. So that's like another piece of irony for us here.
Yeah, it's weird, to say the least. This game is an anomaly for existing.
I want to point out real quick, if you look up Wilco's history, this game is like this huge anomaly, because they do a lot of Japanese-only stuff. A lot of really heavily Japanese stuff. They did a Shin Megami Tensei game, so this is way out of their wheelhouse.
Well, yeah, they did Devil Children Messiah, rather, didn't they?
That sounds about right, yeah.
I'd really love to know how this happened, if it was just like Kemco just told them to do the thing. I don't think Romero was involved with it, but apparently he's okay with the version. He likes this version, so that's good.
Well, I mean, his name is in the game's name still, so there's that.
Appeal to God, approval from God, ergo and henceforth. Yeah, but, Daikatana on the GBC does actually loosely follow the time-hopping structure of the original, where, you know, the first one takes place in present times and even has some relatively sewery bits in them. You aren't being assaulted by... I forget if you're assaulted by frogs at any point, but they're not as terrible as they were in the original. And then you get sent back to what I believe was sort of like medieval... Ancient Greece, I think, first, then like medieval, like Norwegian, icy Arctic castle thingy, and then flung into the far future.
Which at this point is only 10 years away, because I think it's the distant future of 2013 San Francisco, so time is catching up with this title.
Yeah, anyone who decided to set things in, like, the early 21st century is probably kicking their own ass right now. We're way past Street Fighter 2010, for example.
If you think about it, like, if you look, like, because 13, 2000, like, look at, like, 1987 compared to 2000. I mean, I can't blame them for thinking 2013 was going to come out the way it did, but... See, that's what I always like to... I just like making that point.
I'm still in denial that 2020 is an actual year that exists. because it still sounds like a cyberpunk year to me, not like something that we live in.
You know what? The game Vegas Stakes, the second to highest casino in that was the 2020, and it had like croupiers who had very cyberpunky, like half-face metal headgear on it. And I am not talking about Daikatana right now because I'm going to be honest, I'm kind of floundering to say much about the game itself.
Okay, so really quick, it's a Zelda with guns.
Would you say it's a lot like Zelda? Is there a big focus on puzzles or more of an action?
To us, I think that the Zelda comparison is only made because Link's Awakening is probably the most popular action RPG for the console, counting Game Boy and Game Boy Color 1.
Yeah, visually this does resemble Zelda quite a bit, but in actual play...
To be honest, I think it resembles a Pokemon trading card game more.
Wow.
And well, just with regard to style, because the Game Boy Color has this very distinct style. Most of the games don't really look like NES games, even though I think NES and Game Boy Color have not really too similar hardware, but similar-ish hardware. But the Game Boy Color always has this look of black and white, but kind of filled with colors, including for games that are exclusive to Game Boy Color. And Dragon Quest Monsters also shares that style a little bit. Even though gameplay-wise, I thought it was a little bit closer to a Final Fantasy Adventure or Mystic Quest Legend or Quest for Camelot, even though Quest for Camelot has been called a Zelda clone as well.
This game is much better than Quest for Camelot. I can say that with certainty.
I'm not so sure about that, to be honest. But I'm happy. We'll probably get back to that when you rank Quest for Camelot. But one of the big differences in this game, you can jump. And there's a lot of jumping.
Oh, yes. Maybe too much.
Yeah, I think so too. Because so you do the usual stuff you'd expect. You jump over pits. You have the admittedly Zelda mechanic of like falling into like boiling acid and then just appearing on the next platform instead of dying instantaneously, which is very friendly. You also have stuff like conveyor belts. You can jump on to escape. So that was a little bit like some sections in... What's the name again? I completely blinking. It's an NES action adventure. Someone else say something. That's what I'm struggling with. I'm completely blinking. Someone else please say something.
Dead air.
That is very true.
I mean, how would you say the game becomes after like the first few areas? Does it focus more on the action at that point, or is it
after the first few areas? It's kind of over because this game only has 8 levels, and you can probably complete it in about 2 hours. So it's not very long. So
I assume the puzzles don't get very difficult.
Nah, not really. It's mostly just switch this, jump that, go here, enter there, bloody blue.
So I'd say the only real Zelda comparison is graphical style more than anything, right?
Yeah. In fact, I might want to say this one's a little bit more like Star Tropics, sort of, structurally, because this game is actually very linear, however Xerxes wants me to pronounce it. I still don't know anymore after all these years. But you know, this game doesn't have any sort of overworld. You just keep going from dungeony area to dungeony area, and that's pretty much just how it flows.
That's why it reminded me more of Quest for Camelot, which has a similar structure. You have like large-ish levels, which are dungeon-like, and you also can't backtrack. You can backtrack within the same level, but once you move on, you move on. And I think what the game struggles a bit with, so you do have the puzzles, which is nice, but you generally only have so many rooms in every game, so sooner or later you're probably going to run into the correct solution. You do have some stuff like pushing boxes around and finding some key items to like open doors and stuff like that, but it doesn't really do too much with it, and it does like it's jumping a little bit too much. There are some sections where you have to do a lot of jumping without there being any pits. So you're just kind of just jumping up cliffs for jumping's sake, which isn't bad. It doesn't overstay its welcome too much because games were all very short anyway. But I had the feeling the developers squeezed the most out of that jumping mechanic, which is not particularly common on this platform here. But I think it actually worked quite well. The one thing I thought didn't really work all that well is the combat. It's not that difficult because you swing your weapon very fast. There's a lot of enemies where you can just swing a weapon and they just repeatedly run into you and don't really stand a chance. But I found that it's often easier to just ignore all enemies because I don't think you get any drops from them, do you?
I don't believe so either.
Yeah, and you don't get any experience, so there's no levels. So for the most part, of course, you want to eliminate enemies that are in the way or are bosses, but you can just ignore a lot of them, and which also means you go through the game even faster, even though it's already kind of short.
Well, you know, this game's fit for pacifist play and or speedrunning, I guess, so that's a coin in its pot. But yeah, you know, for there being as much combat as there is, it's pretty basic. Just strike and avoid, and that's pretty much all there is to it.
You also have multiple characters. What? Oh, sorry. I was just mentioning, you also have multiple characters. You sort of have them. You normally have a party, but the game just switches your character up when it's appropriate plot-wise. And other than that, your other party members don't really do much.
I mean, like there was in the original Light Katana, there's Hiro, Mikiko, I think, and our buddy Superfly, of course, the best
naturally.
And there is absolutely no difference whatsoever in their abilities. I will harp on that being a fault, because I feel like something that could potentially enrich this game is like giving all three characters special abilities that they need to clear areas, kind of like the Lost Vikings. I mean, you know, like Hiro could be the best jumper, Mikiko could be the best runner, Superfly could use his strength to push stuff out of the way. You know, just an idea for enriching a very straightforward and basic game, the more I analyze it. But I will say this, at least you don't have to attempt to wait until forced AI partners try to leave the level with you, or get stuck on level geometry instead, whichever happens first.
That's very true.
So there is that. Really, I just think that the main reason this game is remarkable at all is because it is a zircon of a game to have been dropped out of a giant bolus of shit. And even so, this game itself on its own is, I don't know, is mediocre too harsh to say? Am I being too hard on it?
No, I don't think so. It's middle of the road, but not in a bad way.
Yeah.
So this isn't like a 5 out of 10 middle of the road, because that's not how games are ranked in general.
The big thing is they turned a game that was very remarkable for all the wrong reasons into something just unremarkable, and that's almost a step down, if you ask me.
Yeah, you know, as far as notability goes, this game, for its very limited release, is sort of a footnote in the giant Daikatana / Iron Storm / John Romero legacy. I don't even think it got a mention in Masters of Doom, although it's been a little while since I read that book. But it's just weird that this game even exists at all. It is a bizarre little curio that is more interesting for what it is rather than what it does. It's an admirable effort. You know, it's not a totally bad game. There's some decent quality put into it. It's a nice little, you know, it's an afternoon breeze type of game. And you'll probably forget ever having played it down the line. But, you know, at least for that one afternoon, it was pretty good.
That is true. Oh, by the way, I wanted to compare this game to Crystallis about half an hour ago. Only because of the jumping that felt very Crystallis.
Crystallis kicks this game's ass. I'm sorry.
That is very true. But I mean, we've also compared it to Link's Awakening, and most people probably say that Link's Awakening is also a better game.
It's my favorite Zelda game, man. This is, I mean, my least favorite Zelda game that I played is Twilight Princess. Feel free to at me for that one. And this game, I don't think, is as notable as Twilight Princess. So
no, that's, I mean, justification. Yeah, it's somewhat unknown because it received a very limited release. Generally, it says that it was released in Europe, which is true, but Europe consists of a lot of countries, so even there, the release was limited. Interestingly, this game is not particularly expensive. You can get a box copy with manual and everything for something like £10 to £15. So despite this, its relative rarity when it comes to having been released, this hasn't even turned into some sort of like little Samson collector's item.
The game, for being such a technically rare game, the demand for it is low, and that's why you don't see major prices for it. And that's pretty ironic. You rarely ever see that actually happen on the modern bullshit pricing bubble collector's market that we're currently living in and probably won't be out of anytime soon. But, this game is just weird. Everything surrounding this game is weird. The game itself is a pretty plain yogurt game. And I am stretching for time until it hits the 20-minute mark.
That's
anything to say in the next 10 seconds?
I do have something to say about the story. We've already talked about it, but
That's more than 10 seconds.
That the story is probably the most remarkable part of the game, because the game does have a fair amount of dialogue.
Oh, yeah, and that's a good point. I don't remember any of it, but it commits to it.
Yeah, it also squeezes a lot in. You'd think it would just say, like, oh, this is about time travel. Just travel through, like, four periods of time, and then you just defeat the bad guy. It does way more. You have the story about the main antagonist being this very antagonistic ruler who has a monopoly on the vaccine for a virus that affects a ton of people. And he's also running a concentration camp. It's called that. If you save the game, it shows you the current area.
Classy.
It very much is. And so Superfly Johnson is the ex-head of security. And the reason why he's initially imprisoned when you meet him is because he defied the main antagonist, which is laudable. But then again, if you're working for the guy who has monopolized the vaccine for the virus that's affecting the entire country, and you work in a concentration camp, maybe you should just have a look at, like, what your job description says. I mean, he signed up for that initially. So maybe Johnson's strength is, like, more physical than mental. I don't know, because the game doesn't really comment on that too much, which may also be for the better. But the game has a couple of oddities like that, and some of them are also technical. Like the intro sequence where you fight three of your students, and then the main character, like, here immediately says, like, oh, I'm too tired. After, defending himself against three attacks and stuff like that. So it feels a little bit quirky in that regard. But a lot of it's limited to the platform, because the Game Boy Color obviously isn't a realistic-looking console. And they do have slightly cartoonified characters. So everything has this weird mix of being very dark and somewhat gritty, but also being on the Game Boy Color, which doesn't really do gritty all that well.
Yeah. I do have a question about the story that I doubt any of you will be able to answer, but I'll give it a shot anyway. Does this, or how much does this version's story deviate from the plot of the original PC version?
It's mostly the same, but shorter.
Okay.
So the PC version is already the longer one. The N64 has, I think, only like 75% of the levels. And this one here is even shorter. It has 8 levels in total.
Wow.
And so there's less of that. But they do keep in a lot of the story. My favorite part is actually where... So the Daikat Hammer was originally forged and then discarded because it was too powerful. And you see one of the characters throw it into a chasm. But then it's recovered and the guy just... He just takes a rope and just, like, upsides into the chasm and just recovers the sword. And this is kind of ingenious how simple that is. You'd think they would like, throw the sword into a volcano or maybe, like, just in the ocean or so, but no, it's just at the bottom of a chasm. And anybody can climb down and just recover it, the very powerful time-traveling sword. And that's exactly what the bad guy does. And I think that's kind of hilarious. The mix between... Like the game being somewhat gritty and serious because the fate of the world's at stake, but it's also kind of dumb. But I kind of like that.
That does kind of sound like it fits in with the tone that Romero at least attempted, being relatively tongue-in-cheek as it is.
Yeah, but I'm not quite sure whether the game is in on the joke.
That's a good point.
Not this version. They probably didn't get any kind of camp going on with this.
Nah. All I can really remember of the plot is that there is a pretty drastic twist at the very end, and the final boss is blankety blank. I would say that the attempt to at least give this game a decent rolling narrative is admirable, if nothing else. Whether or not it's worth playing the game at all is certainly up to you, but This game is at least relatively easy to finish without a bunch of patches, which you even wonder if they're worth the effort. And I have no idea if we're going to cover the PC original someday, but this game now, right here, that we're discussing is probably not going to rank incredibly high.
No.
So let's
get on
to that.
Shall we move on to that? Yes.
So, any ideas, anyone?
I sort of have an idea.
Sure, Tex, what's up?
So, at 374, we have Dragon Force. That's... And just because it's kind of RPG-ish, that reminds me of that. That I think is a better game. I can't really explain why. I just kind of looked at that and said, I think it has to go below that.
Okay. Yes, no, it is going below Dragon Force.
Yes, definitely. And, we really ranked Zombies Ate My Neighbors low.
Yeah, and we also have Dead to Rights at 387, which is also kind of dumb.
I would put this below Zombies Ate My Neighbors. That has a lot more soul to it.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's also Donkey Country 3. I mean, Donkey Country 3, it's really low. It's almost at 400. But it's better than this. I mean, this game isn't terrible, to be honest. The main flaw is that it doesn't really do anything particularly right. And as Sotang already said, its main characteristic is that it is a kind of okay version of an infamously bad game.
I got a suggestion here. I think Satanga might be okay with this.
Oh, what's up?
What about between Neon Genesis Evangelion and Duke Nukem 3D?
At 419.
I'm going to bring the cheese, but I don't know.
I don't think that's a bad idea, but I think I would place it even lower than that. I would find it a little bit too painfully ironic if this altered version of an infamously bad first-person shooter were to rank higher than a legendary, if not overrated.
That doesn't count. This is a totally different genre.
Oh, I guess you're right.
Yeah, but is it better than Mortal Kombat Trilogy?
To be honest, I had more fun with this than I had with playing Mortal Kombat Trilogy, but that's also because I don't really like fighting games all that much.
Is Clay going to love Clash of Steel?
Oh, I've got, good point. Landstalker is right under Clash of Steel.
Above it.
Yeah, this game is not isometric, and the jumping actually works pretty well, in my opinion. So this goes all
the way up Landstalker. Between Clash of Steel and Landstalker.
I'm okay with that. What about you guys?
Wow.
I think that sounds fair.
I will say that is somewhat higher than I expected this to land, but by that reasoning, I am actually okay. This game is much less frustrating than Landstalker, so I'll give you credit where it's due.
I mean, we've kind of talked this down a little bit, but this game does have some character. The colors are actually quite nice, so it's not kind of brownish, and the music isn't great, but it's also not too grating. So this game doesn't really do too many things right, but it also doesn't do too many things wrong, which I think is laudable.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a fair argument. I definitely don't hate this game. I might have been a little harsh on it speaking about it. It's just that I can't really think of much to suggest playing this over a game that's truly super memorable. But, you know, like I said, if you got a free afternoon and a couple hours, you could definitely do a lot worse. And
like Landstalker.
Oh, what about Landstalker, Clay?
You said you could do a lot worse, like Landstalker.
Well, very a little true. Worse by our ranking now, but one space worse. But, if you're able to play this game somehow, it is interesting to see how they attempted to salvage a decent, all right, perfectly okay game out of a flaming nuclear shipwreck, referring to the original PC version, so... You know, Bob, if you would be willing to put it at 429 between Clash of Steel and Landstalker Treasures of King Null, I think that will conclude this bizarre and somewhat dead air filled discussion. I'm sorry, that's my fault.
We worked with what we had.
That's all for this episode. Special thanks goes out to all of my lovely co-hosts and compatriots. To our booking agent, Blanky G, our theme song MC, Norm. Check him out. He's at Normally Retro on Twitter. And our technical assistant and video editor, Ed Burns.
Now, I know what you're thinking. How do I nominate a game for them to rank and discuss on their show? Well, I'll tell you what. Here's how you do it. You can nominate one game for us to rank via a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Those are the ones we try to get to first. You can also go to bit.ly/rankthisplease and add a game to the slush pile and cross your fingers. But remember, we don't make any guarantees on those. Before you nominate a game, you should definitely check out bit.ly/47kgames and make sure we haven't already ranked it. You'd be surprised how often that happens. That's bit.ly/47kgames. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/hg101. I know I did. And by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us on our Discord server at bit.ly/HG Discord. But most importantly, help us spread the love of games by getting on Apple Podcasts, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it because you like us and you want us to succeed. Until next time, keep keeping it real.